Today in conversation with Rich Gay, an independent producer, and Nancy Savoca, an independent filmmaker. Thank you so much for being here. We're here on another episode of the We Are What We Speak podcast. I am Aaliyah, I'm your host today. I'm super excited because I'm here with two awesome filmmakers that I've had a pleasure of working with in the past, in the recent past. If you wouldn't mind, just go ahead. Who are you? And just in a few words.
I'm Nancy Savoca. I'm an independent filmmaker. I'm not going to introduce you, Rich, because you're going to do that.
I'll do that myself.
Yes, yeah. I don't have to speak for you.
My name is Rich Gay, and I am an independent producer.
Just to start, and maybe you go one at a time, in your own words, as storytellers, as people who help tell stories and bring them alive, how would you define language?
Multifaceted, because there's the language of the obvious, what we all say is language, like speaking the words we speak, and, you know, and everybody comes from different family groups of languages, you know, is it coming from here or there or whatever, and the sounds that come out of our mouths. But then there's the language of visuals and what we see when we look at the other person and their body language and their facial expressions, and that's a language.
And I would say culture is a language in and of itself. Not just the words, but what people do, behavior. Of course, we know body language, part of that. Yeah.
And what does it mean to you? What does that question sort of bring out for you?
For me, it's communication in all its forms. So, and we're receiving information from each other on so many levels. So it's in all these languages, the ones that are concrete and the ones that are you can't put your finger on it, and the way things are presented to me, the way I get things presented to me, and sometimes how I want to poke around the corner of that because I don't want to accept what got presented to me, so I want to see what else is back there. So yeah, and language can be threatening and it can be loving and it can be embracing and it can be divisive, and yeah, so much.
I mean part of what you'll learn on this is that we know each other too long. So the first word that I thought of was communication as well. It's how we understand each other and how we present each other and express what we're feeling, what we're thinking. But mostly, I think, I believe it's mostly what we're feeling is what language does.
What we pick up how we can misunderstand each other and the crossed, like I said this and you heard that. Like, why'd you hear that? You know, or I guess maybe that's what I really meant. I didn't want to say it. Oh, I didn't want to say it. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to pull out some of the more of that. But now I do want to take us back to your childhood, and either of you can start, but how were you socialized to think about language, and were those like explicit or implicit types of messages?
Language was such a big deal in my family. There were three languages. My parents were immigrants, so they arrived with no English. My sister, who was 15 at the time, would tell you they basically my family came from Argentina, and they basically gave her an English book. Like lesson one, hello, when she was 14, and said, study that, we're going to go there. So, and she became their translator when they arrived, like most immigrant kids. So she and my other sister, Tina, who was 13 when they arrived. So there was the language that the language my dad was picking up at work, and the language my mom could not wrap her head around. Really, until the day she died. She lived here 37 years and never really got fluent in English, which is why I'm bilingual, because she could never speak to me in English. And it was a blessing without us realizing at the time. She always told me, she goes, you're going to thank me one day, because you wouldn't know if I don't keep speaking to you in this language, you will forget it in this country. And she was right. At least that happened to people in my generation. So language was very, very important. It was the hurdle. It was the way to understand this new culture that was so different for everybody. It was pain and new. It felt new to them, I think. And I witnessed that just because I was born a few months after they arrived. So I just witnessed immigrant life. Technically, I wasn't, but it's what was all around me. Mm-hmm. And language was a big part of it.
Well, you, Rich?
Yeah, I, immigrant parents, except the languages were French and English. My father was very proud of the fact that he was the only one in his family who had graduated eighth grade in French and English. So he got a bilingual education. And my mother, her first language was English because her parents had immigrated to Canada from England. And so her French was learned, picked up. But my house was, I got a very early understanding of the power of language, because the only time my parents spoke French was when they did not want me to understand what they were saying. French was the language of secrets. So I became very good at understanding French, but I couldn't let on that I understood. Otherwise, I'd blow the game. And as a result, I to this day, I haltingly speak a little bit of French. My mother also had I would call it a complex about French, because she always said that what she spoke was not real French, because it was Canadian, Quebecois French. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like the French spoken in Paris. And she was right. I mean, it is a different type of French. It's actually an old French, what they speak in Quebec. But yeah, it was very much the language of secrets.
Wow. Wow. Okay. I'm going to respond to this first. It's an interesting sort of a story, like language secrets, but also how that's sort of wrapped up in access, you know, and access and validity. Because it really, I mean, I think I've come across a number of people who share that kind of perception of it not being a real French, which I don't know if that's resulted in this really interesting pride around French in Canada, you know, like in schools and things like that. And I don't know really what the source of that is, but it really does seem to be really important, this Canadian French identity. Yeah. This isn't the first time I've heard that.
Yeah. No, I tend to think sometimes that it has to do more with the, you know, I mean, this is a whole other conversation, but this is a very, very big thing in France, from my understanding, about not calling people who's really French. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a second generation immigrant, which I've never even understood the term second generation immigrant, you're an immigrant, and then the second generation is born in that country, they're no longer immigrants, but they have a definition about number of generation immigrant, then they're not really French.
Right. You can be born in France, grow up in France, go to French school and everything, and then you're still not French.
Yeah. So I think I my own prejudice against that. So I think that sometimes that may have something to do with it. But I've heard that before. I mean, I heard you talk about, I've heard the term high Italian.
Oh, yeah. That was my dad. Yeah. Because my father's family's from Sicily, which, you know, is a little bit Italian history. It's like, I think it's 1861, Italy became a country. Before then, it was all these little pockets of kingdoms or whatever. And so Sicily, they have their own languages, like Naples is actually, they're called dialects, but really they're languages. So Sicilian is a language. But when I was a kid, Sicilian is a dialect. And my dad always said, with pride, my father knew high Italian. He would call it high Italian. And it was, it's probably the Tuscan Italian, because that's like the language of Dante, I think, is the language that became more the basis of Italian today. But so, yeah, so it was, you know, what is considered real and not real.
We might come back to this point just because there is some interesting, because if we think about sort of how Italian is viewed today, in like in Italy and those from the north, those from the south, because you sort of navigate into more social economical things that then impact language, right? So now if you're from the south and you speak this way,
that means XYZ, right? And so it's like, okay, we can travel across time to sort of go into modern day Italy and unpack some of this like idea of like prestige.
Yeah, look at you. You've got like two crazy stories here because, and the French-Canadian thing is it's...
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, so language and especially the time I was growing up, we would spend our summers in Canada and language was really important in my childhood up there because it was political. So I was a little kid not speaking French, being up there. My father's best friends would not speak to me. They knew how to speak English, but they would only speak to me in French. Knowing that I didn't, I mean, you know, I got it. I mean, I understood enough, but they refused to speak to me in English because it was about Quebec separatism. And at that time, Quebec really wanted to be its own country, wanted to break apart. I'm not sure when the bilingual laws were passed in Canada, but it had to have been around that time because there was a great debate about, there was a battle, if you will. In fact, going back into the 40s, my parents attempted to get married in the local Catholic church. And the priest took my father aside and he said to him, why don't you marry a nice French girl? Why are you marrying this English girl? So it was very, you know, there were a lot of different walls there. But I just remember very distinctly being, you know, understanding that this language thing is bigger than, it's not just, hey, I want a piece of candy. It was very political.
Yeah. How did you deal with that though? Like, I mean, I can't imagine what the exact exchanges were, but like, how did you deal with this adult deciding, hey, I'm not going to speak to you in this language?
I basically stopped. I wouldn't talk to him. I mean, mm-hmm. It became a divisive thing because it's like, well, I'm not going to talk to him if he's not going to talk to me, you know. And it was the only time in my life when I ever felt like, oh, well, I'm an American, and he should speak to me, you know.
How old are you?
I want to say that I was 9 or 10 maybe when I first really remember this happening. It was right around, you know, it was the late 60s, right around 1970. That was when there was a lot of stuff going on, as I recall. So yeah, I really had there was just a lot of resentment. And then I had, I had the well-meaning cousins who would talk to me and who were bilingual. I mean, that was the thing. Almost all of my family, unlike your family, Nancy, all of my family was bilingual. Many of them had immigrated had come to New York. They lived in New York. They spent, you know, part-time or, you know, on various sides of the border. So they all spoke English, but they would try to speak to me in French and say, come on, you want to learn French, you know? And it was, but it was completely not like, it was not important to my parents' agenda, even though they were bilingual. It was at the bottom of the list of what an education was.
Yeah, you know, what the word that comes to mind with both of your stories is preservation. I'm interested in, like, in all of this experience and in this growing up, was there a sense that they were speaking to you in this way and in the way language was handled in your household, Nancy, for the purposes of preserving culture and preserving the dialect / language? Was there a sense of that?
Yeah, I think those folks up in Canada who were refusing to speak to a little kid in a language that the kid understood, I think that's what they were doing. I think so. My parents had no interest in preserving anything that went on in their childhood. Yeah. So no, I don't, you know, and they never said, like, you know, you hear a lot of stories. I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories of parents not wanting their kids to learn the language because they want them to assimilate. I mean, nobody ever said that, but that was kind of what it was. My parents were doing, but they didn't make any kind of declaration. And on the other hand, not only they didn't make that declaration, and they never became citizens of the United States. Mm. They had green cards. Then they were, and they could have, and they knew they could have, and they said, "Well, what do I want to do that for?" They were not interested in that sort of stuff. So I don't know. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, but it's interesting.
It is a kind of a weird mix, because on the one hand, it's like assimilated. On the other hand, but I'm not going to assimilate. You do it, Rich.
Yeah. I mean,
me and your mom are going to stay Canadian, but you can't learn French.
Right.
It's interesting. It's like, well, yeah, what you almost want to say, like, I wish I could go back and ask them what was going on. My mom was very clear with me. I think my mom, what she wasn't clear with was, I think, was herself. I think she had an incredible sadness and longing to go back home. There was some kind of block that she couldn't learn the language. Sometimes she would get angry and blame my father and say, you know, I wanted to go to night school and learn English and continue teaching, because she had been a teacher in Argentina. And your father wouldn't let me. So it went that way sometimes. But she would also say to me the importance of the language, the importance of pronunciation. I remember I got a lot of those lessons as a kid from different people in English and in Spanish about pronunciation. I remember my mom saying, you know, we live amongst people that speak or coming from all different countries. Like, hold on to yours. Hold on to the way we say things. And it's funny, it's not the Argentine zho, zho, zho that everybody thinks they know about. It's actually a very Western, my mom's from Mendoza, so it's a very different Spanish. And she said, but that's where you're coming from. So hold on to that one. I had a sister who was very interesting. Her way of adaptation is that she would speak the accent. She would speak in Spanish with the accent of the country that the person she was speaking to. So when she was with her Puerto Rican friends, she sounded Puerto Rican. When she was with Dominican friends, she sounded Dominican. When she was with Cuban friends, she sounded Cuban. And she was really good. And it wasn't a mimic. It was like this super, because she's still, I see it. She does it today as an older woman. I see her. It's like an empathy thing. Like, she gets in so into connecting with that person that she needs to communicate in the same forms with the same, and she's good at it. It sounds really good. It doesn't sound like fake, you know? Whereas my mom was really clear on the different accents. She would speak to someone and say, okay, she's from Colombia. She knew her accents really well, but she preserved her own. So I was really like, that was conversations. We talked about language all the time, especially because we were Latin Americans in a country with a lot of other Latin Americans.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. There's a term for that, actually.
Oh, yeah. I'm learning from you. What's the term?
Yeah. So the term is linguistic accommodation, actually. So it's something that you, okay, I'm not a linguist. I am an enthusiast. And so I'm excited to have someone on the show who is a linguist who will be able to do this a lot more effectively. But the idea is that you do it in order to be better understood, but also to demonstrate that you value what the other person is saying. So it's kind of unconscious, right? So then you sort of, the idea of mimicking, it might seem like a negative like idea, but really it's about, I want to make sure we are understanding each other, but also that you know that I like value you. And it's interesting because certain power things come into play too, because you might accommodate with someone who has more power than you in an attempt to be seen by them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, in your sister's case, it really just might be this, like, I want us to be understanding each other and connecting with each other. But depending on the environment.
Right. Sometimes it's survival. Like, absolutely. I'm going to leave, as my neighbor taught me again, as a little girl sitting on the stoop in the Bronx, is like, she lined up a bunch of, I just remember this day where me and my girlfriends were sitting on the stoop, and she was like, you better learn to speak correctly. You're going to go out there in the world and people are going to judge you. So don't be doing no Bronx accent to people, and don't be talking like this, because that's not going to work out. You need to speak correctly. And we were like these little kids. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if that must have affected me in some way, because my daughter to this day, when she was little, actually, she used to say, Mom, I know when you get on the phone, I know if you're speaking to people from work or if you're talking to the family, because your voice just changes.
Yeah, I can relate to that. It's interesting because when I think back, when I ask these questions, I'm also trying to reflect. And, you know, I don't really recall explicit messages around language? I mean, we can talk about school in a little bit because that is a really big part of language.
I don't know nothing. My teacher's nothing. You're not going nothing. You're not going picking nuts.
Right. Yeah. Ain't. Right. Ain't.
Don't use ain't. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get a lot of that stuff at home. Not that
at home.
Not at home. Right. At home, it was more like I saw it. I observed it. So that the phone thing was like a go-to because you're like, oh, somebody important or somebody of power or something of influence is on the phone.
Yes.
You know, or when she's on the phone with her mom. Like I can tell.
Totally.
We could tell. It was different. It was different. Yeah. So I feel like that's a really common experience for a lot of people.
And as children, right, you're watching like, you know, when your mom's voice goes up and it's kind of like, the pitch goes up, so it gets a little bit like, and she steps back as a person. Or when she's up front and her voice goes low because she's talking to you and you didn't make your bed.
Well, what's funny is because I've been around Spanish for 45 years now. And when she's speaking Spanish on the phone, I know that I can hear the difference between the way you would talk to your sister or your brother or someone you don't. No, there's a definite difference.
That's code switching, right? That's code switching.
Yeah. And so and a lot of people do that. And, you know, we can talk nuances like code switching versus style shifting. But I wonder if, you know, Rich, your ability to perceive, depending like who Nancy's talking to, if it goes back to that like childhood, you know, your parents speaking French and doesn't want you to know, but you still picked up, though.
Yes.
Lots of understanding. Do you feel like any of that has come with you into your relationship?
I'm sure it has. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I never really thought about it till now, but I'm sure it has. Because again, I don't speak Spanish.
You do.
Well,
actually.
I can, but I don't really.
Under duress.
Under duress. If we go to Argentina and I'm with some of your family members who don't speak any English, right, then I will find the words.
Oh my God. The word you used to describe duress. It's just really
true.
No, because it's like he's like a deer caught in the headlights, like, oh no, I gotta speak Spanish.
Oh
but
my
he
gosh.
Has it. He has
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So I can relate to that. There's a few languages that really make me feel that way where I can understand more than I can say. And so, you know, there are times where I'm like, I'm getting you. And then it's my turn to contribute. And I'm like, and you just rely on the structures and the grammar you have. And it's really simplified, but you're like, whoa.
That has to do with, I feel like that has to do with being in this country because definitely growing up, and I don't know if it's gotten much better. We were shamed to know more than English. English plus something else meant, unless it was French, you know, French taught
fancy,
in schools,
right?
French taught in schools, right? Mm-hmm. Not even like, not French Canadian.
No.
That's really the only language I remember. Again, my perceptions as a child, I thought was important, an important language. And then everything else was like, you know, it was that you really didn't belong and like hide it, get away from it. Or as the ladies would tell me when my mom went shopping at Woolworths is like, you know, tell her to learn English. She's in America now. Like that was like the big, by the way, then I learned from the nuns in Argentina, America is north and south. So she's always been in America.
Yeah.
But so these are the things that, you know, were hurled at my mom. And my mom, like Rich, knew English, just couldn't speak it. And she would sometimes tell me, tell this woman to go F herself. And I'm like, I'm not translating that, Mom. I'm 7 years old. You put me on the spot and I'm not going to do that. But, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, this idea, it's actually something I wrote down before, just speak English. That's a phrase that a lot of people are familiar with. And we often equate the ability to speak English and English without quote unquote an accent as this unique identifier of Americanism. Can you talk a little bit more about how you all sort of dealt with this idea of proper English growing up?
Well, I don't know about you, but I mean, at that time, I mean, I bought it. This is what we call systemic, right? I mean, it's everywhere. Everyone is giving you that message. So what am I going to, you know, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? about that. And again, my parents were not. I don't think if I had used the word assimilation with my parents, that they would have a clue as to what I meant. But it's kind of what they were doing. You know, I was a New Yorker. I was from the Bronx. And that's, you know, and that identification was very important until I got down to Manhattan and I went to NYU and I was in the business school.
College.
And now I'm not from the Bronx anymore. I'm from the Bronx. Mm. That's where I was. I was born in the Bronx. We wouldn't even say I'm from the Bronx. I think I'd say I was born in the Bronx. Or something like that.
Like, but it's from a long time ago.
Yes,
you
like
are
a
no
long
longer
time
there.
Ago.
Yeah, class comes into it.
Yeah.
Class comes into it for sure.
Definitely. I mean, we're talking a little bit about school. What sort of things were different about the people around you? And by different, I mean like the diversity of language and voice and accent. I'm thinking back to this video/challenge thing. It was really about linguistic celebration, right? It was like New York accent challenge or something.
Right.
Right. And there was like a series of people, I think, saying the same sentence, if I'm recalling correctly. And the idea was like, who's got the best accent? And it was a competition, but it was this idea of like, how do you highlight the different types of voices that is in New York, that are in New York?
Yeah.
Did you all have any friends that you might feel like you want to talk about today who just really stood out to you because of their language background or their pride in their language?
I think what was so rich and why I feel so privileged and the way I grew up is that I did grow up with people that came from everywhere. And I don't at for a second want to say that we all lived in harmony.
Right.
We didn't. Mm-hmm. Nobody did. People were fighting each other. People misunderstanding each other. People were not trusting each other. People were so looking at each other sideways because they were coming from different places. And from different places, I mean that we could even all be Latinos and be questioning each other, that we could all be Black and be questioning each other because somebody came from, you know, who comes from Martinique and who comes from Jamaica and who comes from the south of the United States and who comes from Cuba and who comes from Puerto Rico and who comes from the Dominican Republic and who comes from Argentina and who comes from Italy. So you had all these people kind of living together, you know, because that's the neighborhood everybody lived in. So speaking to each other, I think as little children, we got a lot of, we just cross-fertilized our accents. I remember my girlfriend's mother going, stop using the word man. Because this was like the 60s and 70s. So we were like, man. And my girlfriend's friend, my girlfriend's name was Ann, and I was Nancy. So she used to call me Nan. So I'd be like, oh, man, Ann. And she'd be like, oh, man, Nan. So we'd be like back and forth. And every time, like, her mother would catch us, stop saying man. I was like, no, I was saying Ann. And she said, no, I was saying Nan. So we would get away with that. But this constant message from the adults of pulling us away from street language, I think, to bring us, make us respectable so that we can go out there in the world and, you know, kind of just putting on a suit, like putting on a suit, but putting on a suit on your language. So to dress yourself up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, my first 8 years were in the Bronx in Catholic school. And Sister Justin definitely had the way to get the street language out of you. She knew how to do that.
What'd she do? Wait.
Hurl the eraser?
No, the Sister Mercy had a heck of an arm. Erasers and chalk would come flying. But in that environment, in this neighborhood in the Bronx, I was the minority being French, Canadian, whatever, Canadian, because it was everyone in my class. There was a huge school. Huge. There were two classes of 50 kids for each grade. So there were 800 kids in this school. And Irish and Italian, all. I mean, it was like 80% Italian, you know, 20% Irish and me. And then for high school, I went to Bronx High School of Science, which drew from kids from all over the city. And all of a sudden, I had Black friends and I had Chinese friends and Korean, Chinese and Korean, wait a minute, that's different, you know, all that stuff, and Latinos and Jewish friends. And so I started to get, you know, I mean, we'd always had a lot of, my family had some Jewish friends. So the New York Yiddish thing was always part of growing up. And I still love that.
Everybody spoke Yiddish. Every ethnic group spoke Yiddish in New York. It's so crazy. And they spoke, not like we weren't fluent in it, but we had the words for it. So it's like doesn't matter what your background was, like you could say, I'm not schlepping that thing.
Oh my God. So this this just reminds me of this one scene in like Sons of Anarchy where one of the characters, the one character who was, he's like part Puerto Rican, and they're like, you're allowed to be in the biker gang because you're not totally Puerto Rican. And there's some rival gang who speaks Spanish, and they all turn to the one Puerto Rican. He's like, can you translate? And he's like, no, I speak better Yiddish. Like I just remember.
Hilarious. Yeah. He's from New York, probably.
Yes, yes. And I just thought that was something that stood out because it was a well-written show. And that was a beautiful line that just really, I think, speaks to what you just shared. Everybody knows.
It was in the culture. It was part of our culture. And it's dying out because I was working with a high school student with a short film he was doing. And I remember using some, I don't know, it's like, it's all focata, or I don't know what word I use. And he just turned to me and said, what's that? And he was Puerto Rican and Mexican. And I said, honey, you don't know. You know what he just said? I said, that's Yiddish. And he's like, what's that?
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, and he, you know, he's 15 years old. So, he didn't know because changing New York.
Yeah. Wow, that's, I'd like to talk a lot about like the differences in bringing language sort of to different generations and this idea of dying languages. You know, we're losing languages all the time, right? Yeah. And this is an interesting moment.
I'm really curious now, like if you're a young person in New York, like is it Arabic? Are you coming in with like some slang in Arabic? Because that's, you know, that's a nice big wave that we've got now. And
because the neighborhood we lived in, I mean, the one I grew up in, which was all Italian, is now known as Little Yemen.
Oh,
yeah.
So it's really changed.
So you're thinking kids are in school. And again, everybody's, you're picking up what your friends are saying because we always do that in Spanish and Spanglish. It's like you mix Itaniolo, like you, Spanish and Italian, you mix the languages just so you're playing around. Yeah. And then a kid who's not of that background at all just loves the sound of that word and just will pick it up and run with that too.
Yeah, I think it's a cool thing we're getting into. And I don't know the word for this either, but this idea of mixing, loan words. And it's not that they're official loan words, like English has certain words that aren't technically English, they're actually French, you know. And I really feel like this is what we've been experiencing, but maybe at a more like a smaller level where in your friend group you're picking up words from different places and introducing into your vocabulary. I like that, and I'm wondering if some of those kids do know Yiddish, they just don't know that it's Yiddish,
right? Because it could have been passed down, and because they could hear their parents speaking, saying, using those words for that, and then again picking up in the current climate. Who else is coming in and throwing in some words in our pool that we're liking it?
And it's great. You know, it's great because it's, I think we pick up the words that really express what we're feeling, you know?
That English doesn't do it as good, you know?
You can't find the English word that, I mean, that's why, you know, I mean, cursing is a whole other subject, right? Of a whole other category of words.
Oh, we could do a whole show on cursing. It's so much fun.
But it's just, there's no other word that expresses what you're feeling, you know? If you're talking about suris, you know, like, you know, suffering, you know, certain things like schmuck or schmendrick, those words just, I don't know, they just fit. It's
like Rich revels. As a Catholic boy, he just revels in Yiddish.
I love it. Yeah.
Okay. What's some of your favorite words then?
Oh my God. Well, I just hit you with a couple, you know, and fakakt and fatotst.
My dog always looks fatitzed. My dog looks fatitzed.
You know, I mean, famished is another one. But I do love suris. It's just suffering. It's pain. It's, you know.
Yeah. I remember my Jamaican girlfriend always used to say it's agita, gives me agita. And that's Italian. That means heartburn. So it's just like, again, like just it got it got put in the mix somewhere. And people went, that sounds like what I feel like.
Yeah.
That those sounds sound much more what I feel like than saying heartburn.
I like it. Oh my gosh. I wish I had like a little monitor, because the really cool thing about social media is that you get to transmit these different voices and stories across places so much more quickly, right? We're in a globalized world. And I like to track some of the language stuff. And there was, you know, a spate of people doing videos imitating different languages. Mm. And the one thing that was super clear is the intonation. And so even though they weren't really saying things, they're like, this is what I think Spanish is. And really it was like the mannerisms, and they were pulling out, you know, and it was hilarious. And it was really just like, how do you celebrate people? It's like, it was. So, okay.
Oh my God. Yeah. You just gave me, just brought back a memory. My uncle Jesus in Argentina, his favorite thing was to pick up the daily, because my dad, when we would stay there for a long time, he would go downtown and to the international kiosk and buy a daily news newspaper and bring it back to my grandmother's house. And my uncle would open it up and he would start reading it super fast in English. He didn't speak English. So it was like whatever he thought that word was. And he would just, like what you're doing right now, we would like hysterical laughing. Yeah.
I feel like I'm underprepared, because there's an Italian song that was released and they were like, this is English. And it wasn't, but it was a hit.
Yes.
Do you know this
song? The 60s?
I think so. I just remember seeing like the music video for it, and it's
Buonasera, signorina, buonasera, is it? And then it's like, it's time to say goodnight to Napoli. And it's like this guy who's doing it phonetically. And then he goes, and then we go walking to the church, and we go walking or so. And you know he doesn't know what the hell he's saying.
Yeah, but it was a hit.
It was a hit.
And it was, I mean, it's really cool. It's amazing. Yeah.
Think a lot of these singers from the early 60s, I remember because my parents used to buy these albums, like Connie Francis and Nat King Cole. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think, there were more, because we had the albums. Canta en español. So they will sing in Spanish. And the Nat King Cole Spanish album is one of the most beautiful albums. He did all these Latin American songs, and it was like a super hit. And it sold a lot because people at that time, I think, immigration, but also I think there was like just this great appreciation for these other cultures that were happening. And I think Connie Francis, who was Italian American, had a Yiddish album too. So, and her father, because I met her, I remember we were working on a project with her, and she said, my dad had me do recordings in all these languages. I think she did German, French, Spanish. Pop hits. They were on the pop hits.
Right. And that's the whole music is language, right? Language is music. I mean, it wasn't just unique to U.S. artists, right? I mean, you look at Charles Aznavour, who is Armenian, right?
Armenian-French, right?
French. And his version of Venice Without You, which is in Spanish, is incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's like
so
the best thing.
So it's a French guy singing a song about an Italian city in Spanish.
In Spanish. And it's beautiful. A beautiful song.
It's beautiful.
But, I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of my favorite artists do that. You know, they navigate these really awesome artistic waters in languages that maybe they didn't grow up with. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
That's really cool.
I really like collaborating with, not me, but when they collaborate with artists.
I think that's very courageous. That would terrify me.
Yeah.
Oh, no, but I think that, and that appreciation that you have, you are collaborating, because as a listener, you become part of that conversation.
Did you hear
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
We're collaborators.
You're collaborators.
Oh, my gosh.
More with Nancy and Rich in part 2.